It was grasping anything other than the fear of what would be waiting behind that door. He embraced it.
"Hold up, all y'all."
The voice was low and rough and wet, like the man's vocal cords had been taken out and dragged through mud. He stood in the center of the ice tunnels, intersecting before them. Military police body armor, two sizes too small, straining to keep his bulk in. His accent and build said he was Martian. Amos and Holden paused, turned, looking everywhere but at the man before them. Prax followed their gazes. Other men lurked, half-hidden around them. The sudden panic tasted like copper.
"I make six," Holden said.
"What about the guy with the gray pants?"
Amos asked.
"Okay, maybe seven. He's been with us since we left the ship, though. He might be something else."
"Six is still more than three," Naomi said in their ears. "You want me to send backup?"
"Hot damn, we've got backup?" Amos asked. "Gonna have Super Teyaporn come down and talk them all to death?"
"We can take them," Prax said, reaching for the pistol in his pocket. "We can't let anyone..." Amos's wide hand closed over his own, keeping the gun in his pocket and out of sight.
"These aren't the ones you shoot," Amos said. "These are the ones you talk to."
Holden stepped toward the Martian. The ease with which he held himself made the assault rifle on his shoulders seem almost innocuous. Even the expensive body armor he wore didn't seem at odds with his casual smile.
"Hey," Holden said. "There a problem, sir?"
"Might be," the Martian drawled. "Might not. That's your call."
"I'll take not," Holden said. "Now, if you'll excuse us, we'll be on..."
"Slow down,"
the Martian said, sidling forward. His face was vaguely like someone Prax had seen before on the tube and never particularly remarked.
"You're not from around here."
"I am," Prax said. "I'm Dr. Praxidiki Mung, chief botanist on the RMD's Southern Soy Farm Project. Who are you?"
"Let the captain do this," Amos said.
"But he's pretty good at it."
"I'm thinking you're part of the relief work," the Martian said. "Long way from the docks. Looks like you lost your way. Maybe you need an escort back to where it's safe."
Holden shifted his weight. The assault rifle just happened to slide forward a few inches, not at all provocatively.
"I don't know," Holden said. "We're pretty well protected. I think we can probably take care of ourselves. What kind of fee are you, escorts asking?" "Well now, on count three of you, call it 100 in Martian script, 5 local. How about you follow us down, and I'll arrange passage for all of you off this ice ball."
The Martian's jaw dropped.
"That's not funny," he said.
But the mask of power and confidence had slipped. Prax had seen the hunger and desperation behind it.
"I'm going to an old tunnel system," Holden said. "Someone abducted a bunch of kids right before everything went to hell. They took them there. Doc's kid was one of the ones that got snatched. We're going to get her back and politely ask how they knew all this was coming down. Might be resistance. I could use a few people who know what end of the gun points forward."
"You're fucking with me," the Martian said.
From the corner of his eye, Prax saw one of the others step forward, a thin woman in cheap protective weave.
"We're OPA, Amos said, then nodded at Holden. "He's James Holden of the Rocinante."
"Holy shit," the Martian said. "You are. You're Holden."
"It's the beard," Holden said. "My name's Wendell. Used to work for Pinkwater Security before the bastards took off, left us here. Way I figure, that voids the contract. You want to pick up some professional firepower, you ain't gonna find better than us."
"How many you got?"
"Six, counting me."
Holden looked over at Amos. Prax felt Amos shrug as much as saw it. The other man they'd been talking about was unrelated after all.
"All right," Holden said. "We tried to talk to local security, but they didn't give us the time of day. Follow me, back us up, and I give you my word you'll get off Ganymede.
Wendell grinned. He'd had one of his incisors dyed red with a small black and white design on it.
Anything you say, boss, he said. Then, lifting his gun, form up. We got us a new contract, people. Let's get it done.
The whoops came from all around them. Prax found the thin woman beside him, grinning and shaking his hand like she was running for office. Prax blinked and smiled back, and Amos put his hand on Prax's shoulder.
See? Told you. Now let's get moving.
The hallway was darker than it had seemed in the video. The ice had thin melt channels like pale veins, but the frost covering them was fresh. The door looked like any other of 100 they'd passed on the way in. Prax swallowed. His stomach ached. He wanted to scream for May, to call her name and hear her call back.
Okay, Naomi said in his ear. I've got the lock disabled. Whenever you guys are ready.
No time like the present, Holden said. Open it up.
The seal around the door hissed. The door opened. Chapter 15. Bobby. 3 hours into the first big meeting between the Martian and UN diplomats, and they'd only just got past introducing everyone and on to reading the agenda. A squat earther in a charcoal gray suit that probably cost more than Bobby's recon armor droned on about Section 14, Subsection D, Items 1 to 11, in which they would discuss the effect of past hostilities on commodity pricing pursuant to existing trade agreements. Bobby looked around, noticed that everyone else at the long oak table was staring with rapt attention at the agenda reader, and stifled the truly epic yawn that was struggling to get out. She distracted herself by trying to figure out who people were. They'd all been introduced by name and title at some point, but that didn't mean much. Everyone here was an assistant secretary or undersecretary or director of something. There were even a few generals, but Bobby knew enough about how politics worked to know that the military people in the room would be the least important. The people with real power would be the quiet ones with unassuming titles. There were several of those, including a moon-faced man with a skinny tie who'd been introduced as the secretary of something or other. Sitting next to him was someone's grandmother in a bright sari, a splash of yellow in the middle of all the dark brown and dark blue and charcoal gray. She sat and munched pistachios and wore an enigmatic half-smile. Bobby entertained herself for a few minutes by trying to guess if Moonface or Grandma was the boss. She considered pouring a glass of water from one of the crystal decanters evenly distributed across the table. She wasn't thirsty, but turning her glass over, pouring water into it, and drinking it would burn a minute, maybe two. She glanced down at the table and noticed that no one else was drinking the water. Maybe everyone was waiting for someone else to be first.
Let's take a short break, Charcoal Suit Man said. 10 minutes, then we can move on to Section 15 of the agenda.
People got up and began dispersing toward restrooms and smoking areas. Grandma carried her handbag to a recycling chute and dumped pistachio shells into it. Moonface pulled out his terminal and called someone.
Jesus, Bobby said, rubbing her eyes with her palms until she saw stars.
Problem, Sergeant? Thorson said, leaning back in his chair and grinning. The gravity wearing on you?
No, Bobby said. Then, well, yes, but mostly I'm ready to jab a stylus into my eye for just a change of pace.
Thorson nodded and patted her hand, a move he was using more often now. It hadn't gotten any less irritating and paternalistic, but Bobby was worried that it might mean Thorson was working up to hitting on her. That would be an uncomfortable moment. She pulled her hand away and leaned toward Thorson until he turned and looked her in the eye.
Why, she whispered, Is no one talking about the goddamn monster? Isn't that why we're here?
You have to understand how these things work, Thorson said, turning away from her and fiddling with his terminal. Politics move slow because the stakes are very high, and no one wants to be the person that screwed it up.
He put his terminal down and gave her a wink. Careers are at stake here.
Careers? Thorson just nodded and tapped on his terminal some more.
Careers?
For a moment, she was on her back, staring up into the star-filled void above Ganymede. Her men were dead or dying. Her suit radio dead, her armor a frozen coffin. She saw the thing's face. Without a suit in the radiation and hard vacuum, the red snowfall of flash-frozen blood around its claws. And no one at this table wanted to talk about it because it might affect their careers? To hell with that.
When the meeting's attendees had shuffled back into the room and taken their places around the table, Bobby raised her hand. She felt faintly ridiculous, like a fifth-grade student in a room full of adults, but she had no idea what the actual protocol for asking a question was. The agenda reader shot her one annoyed glance, then ignored her. Thorson reached under the table and sharply squeezed her leg. She kept her hand up.
"Excuse me," she said. People around the table took turns giving her increasingly unfriendly looks and then pointedly turning away. Thorson upped the pressure on her leg until she'd had enough of him and grabbed his wrist with the other hand. She squeezed until the bones creaked, and he snatched his hand away with a surprised gasp. He turned his chair to look at her, his eyes wide and his mouth a flat, lipless line. Yellow Sari placed a hand on the agenda reader's arm, and he instantly stopped talking.
"Okay, that one is the boss," Bobby decided.
"I, for one," Grandma said, smiling a mild apology at the room, "would like to hear what Sergeant Draper has to say."
"She remembers my name," Bobby thought. "That's interesting."
"Sergeant?" Grandma said.
Bobby, unsure of what to do, stood up.
"I'm just wondering why no one is talking about the monster."
Grandma's enigmatic smile returned. No one spoke. The silence slid adrenaline into Bobby's blood. She felt her legs starting to tremble. More than anything in the world, she wanted to sit down, to make them all forget her and look away. She scowled and locked her knees.
"You know," Bobby said, her voice rising, but she was unable to stop it, "the monster that killed 50 soldiers on Ganymede? The reason we're all here?"
The room was silent. Thorson stared at her like she had lost her mind. Maybe she had. Grandma tugged once at her yellow sari and smiled encouragement.
"I mean," Bobby said, holding up the agenda, "I'm sure trade agreements and water rights and who gets to screw who on the second Thursday after the winter solstice is all very important."
She stopped to suck in a long breath, the gravity in her tirade seeming to have robbed her of air. She could see it in their eyes. She could see that if she just stopped now, she'd be an odd thing that happened, and everyone could go back to work and quickly forget her. She could see her career not crashing off a cliff in flames. She discovered that she didn't care.
"But," she said, throwing the agenda across the table, where a surprised man in a brown suit dodged it as though its touch might infect him with whatever Bobby had, "what about the fucking monster?"
Before she could continue, Thorson popped up from his seat.
"Excuse me for a moment, ladies and gentlemen. Sergeant Draper is suffering from some post-combat-related stress and needs attention."
He grabbed her elbow and drove her from the room, a rising wave of murmurs pushing at their backs. Thorson stopped in the conference room's lobby and waited for the door to shut behind him.
"You," Thorson said,
shoving her toward a chair. Normally, the skinny intelligence officer couldn't have pushed her anywhere, but all the strength seemed to have run out of her legs, and she collapsed into the seat.
"You," he repeated.
Then to someone on his terminal, he said, "Get down here, now."
"You,"
he said a third time, pointing at Bobby, then paced back and forth in front of her chair. A few minutes later, Captain Martins came trotting into the conference room lobby. He pulled up short when he saw Bobby slouched in her chair and Thorson's angry face.
"What?"
he started, but Thorson cut him off.
"This is your fault,"
he said to Martins, then spun to face Bobby.
"And you, Sergeant, have just proven that it was a monumental mistake to bring you along. Any benefit that might have been gained from having the only eyewitness has now been squandered by your idiotic tirade."
"She..." Martins tried again, but Thorson poked a finger into his chest and said,
"You said you could control her."
Martins gave Thorson a sad smile.
"No, I never said that. I said I could help her given enough time."
"Doesn't matter," Thorson said, waving a hand at them. "You're both on the next ship to Mars, where you can explain yourselves to a disciplinary board. Now get out of my sight." He spun on his heel and slipped back into the conference room, opening the door only wide enough for his narrow body to squeeze through. Martin sat down in the chair next to Bobby and let out a long breath.
"So," he said, "what's up?"
"Did I just destroy my career?" she asked.
"Maybe. How do you feel?"
"I feel," she said, realizing how badly she did want to talk with Martins and becoming angered by the impulse. "I feel like I need some air." Before Martins could protest, Bobby stood up and headed for the elevators. The UN complex was a city in its own right. Just finding a way out took her the better part of an hour. Along the way, she moved through the chaos and energy of government like a ghost. People hurried past her in the long corridors, talking energetically in clumps or on their hand terminals. Bobby had never been to Olympia, where the Martian Congressional Building was located. She'd caught a few minutes of congressional sessions on the government broadcast when an issue she cared about was being discussed, but compared to the activity here at the UN, it was pretty low-key. The people in this building complex govern 30 billion citizens and hundreds of millions of colonists. By comparison, Mars's 4 billion suddenly seemed like a backwater. On Mars, it was a generally accepted fact that Earth was a civilization in decay. Lazy, coddled citizens who lived on the government dole. Fat, corrupt politicians who enriched themselves at the expense of the colonies. A degrading infrastructure that spent close to 30% of its total output on recycling systems to keep the population from drowning in its own filth. On Mars, there was virtually no unemployment. The entire population was engaged either directly or indirectly in the greatest engineering feat in human history, the terraforming of a planet. It gave everyone a sense of purpose, a shared vision of the future. Nothing like the Earthers, who lived only for their next government payout and their next visit to the drugstore or entertainment malls. Or at least, that was the story. Suddenly, Bobby wasn't so sure. Repeated visits to the various information kiosks scattered through the complex eventually got her to an exit door. A bored guard nodded to her as she passed by, and then she was outside. Outside. Without a suit. 5 seconds later, she was clawing at the door, which she now realized was an exit only, trying to get back in. The guard took pity on her and pushed the door open. She ran back inside and collapsed on a nearby settee, gasping and hyperventilating.
"First time?"
the guard asked with a smile. Bobby found herself unable to speak, but nodded.
"Mars or Luna?"
"Mars," she said, once her breathing had slowed.
"Yeah,
I knew it. Domes, you know. People who've been in domes just panic a bit. Belters lose their shit. And I mean completely. We wind up shipping them home drugged to keep them from screaming.
Yeah, Bobby said, happy to let the guard ramble while she collected herself. No kidding.
They bring you in when it was dark outside?
Yeah.
They do that for off-worlders. Helps with the agoraphobia.
Yeah.
I'll hold the door open a bit for you, in case you need to come back in again.
The assumption that she'd give it a second try instantly won Bobby over, and she actually looked at the guard for the first time. Earther short, but with beautiful skin so dark it was almost blue. He had a compact, athletic frame and lovely gray eyes. He was smiling at her without a trace of mockery.
Thank you, she said. Bobby. Bobby Draper.
Chuck, he replied. Look at the ground, then slowly look to the horizon. Whatever you do, don't look straight up.
I think I got it this time, Chuck, but thanks.
Chuck gave her uniform a quick glance and said,
Semper Fi, Gunny.
Oorah, Bobby replied with a grin. On her second trip outside, she did as Chuck had recommended and looked down at the ground for a few moments. This helped reduce the feeling of massive sensory overload, but only a little. A thousand scents hit her nose, competing for dominance. The rich aroma of plants and soil she would expect in a garden dome, the oil and hot metal from a fabrication lab, the ozone of electric motors. All of them hit her at once, layered on top of each other and mixed with scents too exotic to name. And the sounds were a constant cacophony. People talking, construction machinery, electric cars, a transorbital shuttle lifting off, all at once and all the time. It was no wonder it had caused a panic. Just two senses worth of data threatened to overwhelm her. And that impossibly blue sky that stretched on forever. Bobby stood outside, eyes closed, breathing until she heard Chuck let the door close behind her. Now she was committed. Turning around and asking Chuck to let her back in would be admitting defeat. He'd clearly done some time in the UNMC, and she wasn't going to look weak in front of the competition. Hell no. When her ears and nose had gotten more accustomed to the barrage of inputs, she opened her eyes again, looking down at the concrete of the walkway. Slowly, she lifted them till the horizon was in view. Ahead of her lay long sidewalks passing through meticulously tended green space. Beyond it, in the distance, was a gray wall that must have stood 10 meters high, with guard towers regularly spaced on it. The UN complex had a surprising amount of security. She wondered if she'd be able to get out. She needn't have worried. As she approached the guarded gate to the outside world, the security system queried her terminal, which assured it of her VIP status. A camera above the guard post scanned her face, compared it to the picture on file, and verified her identity while she was still 20 meters from the gate. When she reached the exit, the guard snapped her a sharp salute and asked if she'd need a ride.
No, just going for a walk, she said.
The guard smiled and wished her a good day. She began walking down the street leading away from the UN complex, then turned around to see two armed security personnel following her at a discreet distance. She shrugged and walked on. Somebody would probably lose their job if a VIP like her got lost or hurt. Once Bobby was outside the UN compound, her agoraphobia lessened. Buildings rose around her like walls of steel and glass, moving the dizzying skyline far enough up that she no longer saw it. Small electric cars whizzed down the streets, trailing a high-pitched whine and the scent of ozone. And people were everywhere. Bobby had gone to a couple of games at Armstrong Stadium on Mars to watch the Red Devils play. The stadium had seats for 20,000 fans. Because the Devils were usually at the bottom of the standings, it generally held less than half that.
That relatively modest number was the greatest number of humans Bobby had ever seen in one place at one time. There were billions of people on Mars, but there weren't a lot of open spaces for them to gather. Standing at an intersection, looking down two streets that seemed to stretch into infinity, Bobby was sure she saw more than the average attendance of a Red Devils game just walking on the sidewalks. She tried to imagine how many people were in the buildings that rose to vertigo-inducing heights in every direction around her, and couldn't. Millions of people, probably in just the buildings and streets she could see. And if Martian propaganda was right, most of the people she could see right now didn't have jobs. She tried to imagine that, not having any particular place you had to be on any given day. What the Earthers had discovered is that when people have nothing else to do, they have babies. For a brief period in the 20th and 21st centuries, the population had looked like it might shrink rather than continue to grow. As more and more women went into higher education and from there to jobs, the average family size grew smaller. A few decades of massive employment shrinkage ended that. Or, again, that was what she'd been taught in school. Only here on Earth, where food grew on its own, where air was just a byproduct of random untended plants, where resources lay thick on the ground, could a person actually choose not to do anything at all. There was enough extra created by those who felt the need to work that the surplus could feed the rest. A world no longer of the haves and the have-nots, but of the engaged and the apathetic. Bobby found herself standing next to a street-level coffee shop and took a seat. "Can I get you anything?" a smiling young woman with brightly dyed blue hair asked. "What's good?" "We make the best soy milk tea, if you like that." "Sure," Bobby said, not sure what soy milk tea was, but liking those two things separately enough to take a chance. The blue-haired girl bustled away and chatted with an equally young man behind the bar while he made the tea. Bobby looked around her, noticing that everyone she saw working was about the same age. When the tea arrived, she said, "Hey, do you mind if I ask you something?" The girl shrugged, her smile an invitation. "Is everyone who works here the same age?" "Well," she said, "pretty close. Gotta collect your pre-university credits, right?" "I'm not from here," Bobby said. "Explain that." Blue seemed actually to see her for the first time, looking over her uniform and its various insignias. "Oh, wow, Mars, right? I want to go there." "Yeah, it's great. So tell me about the credits thing." "They don't have that on Mars?" she asked, puzzled. "Okay, so if you apply to a university, you have to have at least a year of work credits. To make sure you like working. You know, so they don't waste classroom space on people who'll just go on basic afterward." "Basic?" "You know, basic support." "I think I understand," Bobby said. "Basic support is the money you live on if you don't work." "Not money, you know, just basic. Gotta work to have money." "Thanks," Bobby said, then sipped her milk tea as Blue trotted to another table. The tea was delicious. She had to admit it made a sad kind of sense to do some early winnowing before spending the resources to educate people. Bobby told her terminal to pay the bill, and it flashed a total at her after calculating the exchange rate. She added a nice tip for the blue-haired girl who wanted more from life than basic support. Bobby wondered if Mars would become like this after the terraforming. If Martians didn't have to fight every day to make enough resources to survive, would they turn into this? A culture where you could actually choose if you wanted to contribute? The work hours and collective intelligence of 15 billion humans just tossed away as acceptable losses for the system. It made Bobby sad to think of. All that effort to get to a point where they could live like this. Sending their kids to work at a coffee shop to see if they were up to contributing. Letting them live the rest of their lives on basic if they weren't. But one thing was for sure. All that running and exercising the Martian Marines did at one full gravity was bullshit. There was no way Mars could ever beat Earth on the ground. You could drop every Martian soldier, fully armed, into just one Earth city, and the citizens would overwhelm them using rocks and sticks. Deep in the grip of pathos, she suddenly felt a massive weight lift that she hadn't even realized she'd been carrying. Thorson and his bullshit didn't matter. The pissing contest with Earth didn't matter. Making Mars into another Earth didn't matter. Not if this was where it was headed. All that mattered was finding out who put that thing on Ganymede. She tossed off the last of her tea and thought, I'll need a ride. Chapter 16. Holden. Beyond the door lay a long hallway that looked to Holden exactly the same as every other hallway on Ganymede. Ice walls with moisture-resistant and insulated structural plates and inset conduit, rubberized walking surface, full-spectrum LEDs to mimic sunlight slanting down from the blue skies of Earth. They could have been anywhere. We're sure this is right, Naomi? That's the one we saw May go through in the hacker's footage, she replied. Okay, he said, then dropped to one knee and motioned for his ad hoc army to do the same. When everyone was in a rough circle around him, he said, Our Overwatch Naomi has intel on the layout of these tunnels, but not much else. We have no idea where the bad guys are, or even if they're still here. Prax started to object, but Amos quieted him with a heavy hand on his back. So we could conceivably leave a lot of intersections at our back. I don't like that.
Yeah, said Wendell, the pink water leader. I don't like that much either.
So we're going to leave a lookout at each intersection until we know where we're going, Holden replied, then said, Naomi, put all their hand terminals on our channel. Guys, put in your earbuds. Calm discipline is don't speak unless I ask a direct question or someone is about to die.
Roger, said Wendell, echoed by the rest of his team.
Once we know what we're looking at, I'll call all the lookouts up to our position if needed. If not, they're our way out of here if we're in over our heads. Nods all around. Outstanding. Amos's point. Wendell, you cover our asses. Everyone else string out at 1 meter intervals, Holden said, then tapped on Wendell's breastplate. We do this thing clean, and I'll talk to my OPA people about putting a few credits in your accounts in addition to getting you off-world.
Righteous, the thin woman with the cheap armor said, and then racked around in her machine pistol.
Okay, let's go. Amos, Naomi's map says 50 meters to another pressure door, then some warehouse space. Amos nodded, then shouldered his weapon, a heavy automatic shotgun with a thick magazine. He had several more magazines and a number of grenades dangling from his Martian armor's harness. The metal clicked a little as he walked. Amos headed off down the hallway at a fast walk. Holden gave a quick glance behind, gratified to see the Pinkwater people keeping up the pace and the spacing. They might look half-starved, but they knew what they were doing.
Cap, there's a tunnel coming off to the right just before the pressure door, Amos said, stopping and dropping to one knee to cover the unexpected corridor.
It didn't appear on the map. That meant that new tunnels had been dug after the station specs had last been updated.